Welcome back to the Street Smart podcast. I'm here with Mush Khan. And Mush is the founder, co-founder, and CEO?
Both.
Yeah. For Alchemy Industrial, along with many other companies that he's done in the past. So Mush, again, thank you so much for taking time to be here.
Well, I'm happy to be here, Justin. I'm looking forward to this.
Fantastic. So what I hope to accomplish with the Street Smart podcast is a look not just at the entrepreneur and their projects or product that they're providing, but a look at what makes them who they are. Mm-hmm. What makes them able to be an entrepreneur mentally, because it's not for the faint of heart, for sure. And it's something that, like I told you prior to us starting the podcast, I've watched my whole life. You know, my dad owned businesses, mm-hmm. and for whatever reason, I just never could quite get over that that hump. And we'll get there in this conversation. But what I want to start with is, who are you? Where are you from? And how'd you end up in Houston? You look not a native of Texas.
No,
probably.
No, I'm not. But, yeah, as they say, got here as quickly as I could.
That's exactly right. That's the best saying. So
it is the best saying. It's a saying I think that only Texans really understand.
I had someone, I worked for a company at one time that was based in Calgary, and one of the guys I worked with there said, Texas is the only place in the States that if you ask someone where they're from, anywhere else from the United States, they'll say they're from the U.S.
Right.
Texans will say Texas.
That's right. Yeah, proudly so. So I'd like to say I'm from Texas. I think so. Even though I'm not originally from here, I'm happy to be here. So thanks again for having me on. And you know, it's always fun for us to talk about what we're doing here at Alchemy. And I'm happy to share about my particular background. So, I think. First of all, let me say I find myself to be one of the luckiest people in the world in terms of the background that I have, which mm-hmm. is none of my doing. You know, I was just sort of born into the right place and time, into the right people, and which I think is true when you think about successes in any respect or any endeavor. It's really about what kind of opportunities did you have, and now it's incumbent upon us to then do something with it. So my parents are from India.
Okay.
They both came from very small villages in India, like literally one light bulb in the village, not much else.
Did they have the light bulb?
They didn't have the light bulb. I think they got the light bulb like between 2 and 3 on a Tuesday.
Oh, I see. So they had to schedule light bulb time.
that light bulb time, yeah. Too bad for them. It was probably during the daylight hours, so they couldn't get much from it.
Right, but right. They got the worst part of the schedule.
They did, yeah. I think like a lot of immigrants, it impacts their mindset, which is
sure.
that, and it's not right to say they didn't have much because they had a lot, but what they did not have was a lot of sort of like creature comforts and mm-hmm. social status and all those things. And so I think for them, it infused within them this willingness to work and also not to be above any kind of work. And you talked about becoming an entrepreneur. I think there's sort of the glamorous part of being an entrepreneur, but the real part is that it's, 99% of the time is not glamorous. And,
sure.
And I think you've got to be willing to do that work. So I think that for me, I learned that from my parents.
And were they entrepreneurs your lifetime?
Not at all. Well, sort of. Well, let me take that back. I think that, so my dad, who both of them are retired now, my mm-hmm. dad was a pipe fitter.
Okay.
And so he worked, in chemical plants, refineries, pipelines, et cetera, doing that kind of work. My mother was a seamstress. And I remember what she used to do was that she was a designer would come to our house and have like a sketch of a dress or something like that. And my mother was able to make the first version of that.
Oh, okay.
And then the person that came to her, the designer, would take that and turn it into a pattern, that you could then scale up. So she, I guess in many ways, she was an entrepreneur too. It's funny, I didn't even think about that until you asked that question, because I don't think about my parents as entrepreneurs, but in many ways they were.
It sort of begs the question, and we can get into that a little later, mm-hmm. Of how you define an entrepreneur, because it almost sounds like you would define it as not someone that necessarily starts a business, but that can innovate a process or build something or solve a problem that doesn't that isn't currently being solved.
Yeah, and I think that and you and I were talking about this a little bit off air, which is that I think an entrepreneur is someone that absolutely cannot stand a problem not being solved, so much so that they're willing to do whatever it takes to solve that problem, because it's a high risk, frankly, low reward type of a thing.
Most of the time, yeah.
And we hear about all the wonderful success stories, and thank goodness they're there. But
sure.
You know, it's it is difficult to do, and I'm sure we can get into that more. So so my parents moved from India to England, where I was born, and they moved to England because that's where the economic activity or opportunity was, and then they moved from England to the U.S. And if you ask my parents today, they'd tell you that it's because there was more opportunity here in the U.S. than there was in England.
And there was more opportunity in England than there was in India.
It's sort of the bedrock of human mobility.
Sure.
And I think that's a big part of Houston, I think, is it's a real collection of people with like intellectual capital.
Mm-hmm.
Like money capital, not to diminish it, it's important. Or assets, et cetera, are important. But I think nothing is more important than intellectual capital. It's like ideas. Humans evolve society with ideas. So I think with my parents, I saw them doing that in the most, most wonderful, understated way, which was, hey, let's go where the best opportunity is for our family, regardless of how difficult it's going to be. And I think it is difficult. It was difficult for them, but they powered through it. And my parents are both, even today, they're both in the upper 80s, still very hardworking. Mm-hmm. It's just sort of deep within them to keep striving for something.
So in a way, you got to watch in your formative years them bet on their intellectual capital.
Yeah.
In spite of, in some cases, I would imagine, mm-hmm. the actual capital.
That's right.
Capital.
Yeah. They didn't have capital. We didn't have capital growing. not the money kind. One of the other things that I observed from my parents was until very, very recently, they've grown a lot of their own food. And so I remember in England, we always had a garden, and they would, and this is a great, I think, entrepreneurial lesson. You were sharing with me some of the things that you're doing in your career about building things up. Mm-hmm. And so with my parents, what I remember them doing is that they would take, a patch of dirt, not very big, probably about the size of this conference room, and they would go in and I still remember my mother literally, on the ground sifting dirt to get the rocks out, small rocks out.
Mm-hmm.
And she had this sifter that was like the size of a, like a hat.
Basically a colander.
It was a colander, yeah. You may have seen these things, but... And then they would call up local farmers and who had manure, and they'd say, could we get some of it? And
right.
they'd go get it, and they'd put it in. They'd put, peelings from vegetables or whatever. And they were able to turn this small patch of ground into something that was really, really productive, and it was fertile. But what made it fertile was the painstaking...
Yeah, the work.
The work, And so I think business is... so much of business, I think, is... creating that thing that will produce over time, and unfortunately there's no shortcuts to it.
Mm-hmm.
We were talking a little bit about podcasting and et cetera. It just takes time to do it.
Right.
You have to build it, and just like your career or my career, you've got to be the sort of the gardener of your own career and your own business. And so I think my parents were just wonderful examples of that, and they're just good, solid, sort of straightforward people. Not fancy, but they are fancy in the most important ways.
I would say. I think that's well said, and I already know where this is going to go, because as you're talking, I'm listening and saying, man, whether you realized it or not, as a child, you were beginning to forge the sort of mindset and willpower to be an entrepreneur, and it takes both of those things.
It does. Yeah.
Mindset and willpower, but that's not the only thing it takes. It takes solving a problem, like
it
you
does.
Said,
and
lots of people are really good at identifying problems, and few people are willing to stand in that void and say, I can fix that, I think, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, and I'm sure in your career you've experienced both. So you moved to the U.S. Where in the U.S. did you guys move?
So we moved to South Louisiana. If you can believe that, going from England to South Louisiana, just outside of New Orleans. I mean, you talk about like a wicked culture shock.
if you have come from France, it would be less maybe.
Crazy. It was crazy. But I would say this, that I, to this day, I love South Louisiana. This is what I remember from it, Justin, is that I arrived there, and you know, this was 1981, so like 100 years probably before you were born.
But well, I was born in 75, so it was it wasn't 100
close.
Years.
Yeah.
It was close.
It was close.
Yeah.
And so
I still get, like, I think about when I graduated high school in 94, and it was like 30 years ago or whatever.
Yeah.
And to me, I'm like, well, no, that was like 10 years ago.
No, I know.
It's
yeah.
weird, but yeah. So you get here in 81.
81, and so I was probably the first of my kind. You know, in La Place, Louisiana. You know, so
you're probably, talking about English.
Yes. Yeah. I've got a funny story about that. This is really like not complimentary of one person there, but I'll tell the story. So one, and this is kind of maybe encapsulates a bit of the hard entry into that environment.
Sure.
That I was maybe a week there, and I was in the hallway trying to like figure out what do I do, because it was foreign to me too. I didn't know what to do. For example, the very first multiple choice exam I ever took was when I got here. I didn't even know that sort of thing existed, because in England everything was essay, and I remember getting my first exam and multiple choice was in math. I'm like, what the hell is this? What do you, like, where do I show my work? And it was, anyway.
Well, math multiple choice is always great because you could back into the answer.
You can, yeah.
If you wanted to spend the time working all four of them.
Right, that's right. So, which I ended up doing stupidly. Yeah. But
that's what I would do most of the time.
But. So this person came up to me while I was like fiddling with my locker, and she's like, hey, are you from England? Because I heard you're from England. I'm like, yeah, I am. And she said, what language do you speak there? And so at first I thought it was like a joke of some kind.
Are you
kidding
me?
Surely, you know, the messing with the new kid. And so I said,
well, it was your first time in South Louisiana, so I understand why you were confused.
I know, that's right. Yeah. And so I said, well, English. And and so she said, well, can you speak some? This is literally true, Justin. It's almost hard to believe. It is hard to believe, but anyway, so that was kind of my initial entry into...
What did she think she was speaking?
Oh, I don't know. I think at that point in time, I realized I needed to exit the conversation as quickly as possible.
Yeah. So we're doing it.
Yeah, so anyway, but, you know, I think that at the end of... So towards the end of that experience in high school in Louisiana, I really fell in love with it, and... still love South Louisiana. It's just so deep in culture and so interesting. And my experience there was that I don't remember ever meeting an unfriendly person, you know, and I've had so many, you know, friends from Louisiana, and, you know, their parents always embraced me and come on in, have dinner. And, you know, not, it wasn't even a request. It was like, you're having dinner.
Right.
You know, and
right.
Food was always amazing. And
well, it's Louisiana. Their food, Louisiana. The food is amazing.
It is. Yeah. I think it's one of the unique things about America, that we have these places that are so different from each other. You know, Texas is different from Louisiana, which is different from Pennsylvania or, you know, the West Coast or whatever. It's like we've got these different countries that are all
right. It's almost this was going to say, it's almost like truly different countries, and because they have different, you know, country influences in them.
They do, yeah. People may have come from different places. And as we were talking about earlier, then there's sort of the country of Texas, and
right,
you know, and so I love that experience. I went to LSU and then graduated from LSU with a degree in mechanical engineering.
You played football at LSU.
I played football. So I dressed out for one game.
So we have a mutual friend that said, you gotta talk to Mush. He's an English Indian that played football at LSU.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, that.
I know.
Might be the only human on the planet that's that.
So. Yeah, like one of many sort of accidental experiences that I had. And so the lights just went off. I think we need some motion detected. So
we'll wave your arms or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's see if this comes on. There you go. Yeah, perfect. We might have to do that. A little entertainment for your audience. We'll take it.
Brief, man. There's never we just had a boring session. Everything worked exactly the way it should.
Well, there's a shop dog around here too. He's probably likely to come in at any time. So
that would be good.
Yeah, brace yourself.
Maybe he'll turn the lights back on.
He probably will. He'll help out. Let's pray for
it. I appreciated the guy waxing the floor behind the wall there when we were getting started. But, well, what position do you play?
Oh gosh, well I play place kicker, and so I'll tell you the very brief story there. So.
Well, we all know that doesn't count.
It doesn't count. That's why I said pretend football. You know, believe me.
You were closer to football than
that
football.
That's right. Yeah. So, like, they were lucky to give me like shoulder pads.
Did you have the one bar face mask?
I didn't have that. Face mask? No, I demanded like the two bar face.
You wanted
mask.
A real helmet.
Legit.
That's
like,
fair.
Legit. Yeah.
That's fair.
Yeah, I wanted that. So, you know,
I think that's a fair request.
It's a fair request. Yeah. Yeah. It was granted after much consternation. But, you know, but I got it. And so one day I was I think a sophomore in high school, and we were just goofing around during gym class outside. Mm-hmm. And so someone had a football, and I kicked it. And I kicked it soccer style.
Sure.
Or as I would say, like the way you kick
you
something.
You kick it normally.
Yes, yeah. Right. Yeah, I'm like, well, you don't need to call it soccer style. This is the way you kick stuff.
So that's how everyone kicks now.
That's right, yeah. But back then, it was like straightaway kickers.
Yeah, back then they had the special cleat that had the square toe.
Yeah, in the front.
That lifted up.
That's right, yeah.
Gross shoe.
Exactly, yeah. And so so I kicked it, and one of the football coaches noticed that I did it and kicked it this way, and he came up to me like, do you always kick it this way? I'm like, yeah, of course. And so he was like, hold on. And so he went and got like a regular tee. And this was like in high school, I think high school kickers still kick off tees. College, they don't anymore. But so he was like, okay, I want you to kick, like, see those two poles in the air? I want you to kick it in between there. I'm like, okay, that seems pretty easy.
You know? Sure, yeah.
You know, that's pretty wide. And
yeah,
so,
right.
So I did, and it, you know, kind of magically went through, luckily. And so he said, okay, you're coming out for the football.
Congratulations, game. You play football.
You play football. I'm like, oh, well, I don't know what that means, but okay, I'll do it. And so anyway, so one thing led to another. Ended up going to LSU. It was not good enough to be like a scholarship player at LSU, but I did learn a lot there. And so I ended up walking on and spending 2 years on the team. I was very, very lucky and grateful to dress out for one game and to run out onto the field.
Oh, man.
Tiger Stadium on a Saturday night. It was
an insane experience.
It was. I mean, I still remember every moment of that. You know, I'll tell you what I remember the most, though, Justin, is that being around sort of these elite athletes. I'm a good athlete, but, you know, not like those guys.
They're on a different...
They're way almost way. Like different species.
Correct.
You know, and so I remember thinking, like, that guy is like 6'4", 240. He's doing things with his body that I can't even imagine doing. Like, mm-hmm. I'm not that creature, whatever he is.
Right.
You know, and so, but what I also learned was that the truly great players, like the all SEC players, the ones that went to the NFL, mm-hmm. and back then, LSU, and it is coming back now, but it was certainly an SEC competitive program back then, so mm-hmm. you had legit athletes going there that went to the NFL. I remember of those, the ones that went to the NFL, they worked really hard. Like, it
sure.
wasn't just talent.
Sure.
They were in the weight room, they were running, they were in the film room. Like, this is, and that was probably, I think, my very first glimpse of what being a pro really could mean. You know, like, you have to invest in your craft every right. single day.
Right. It really is a job.
It's a job, and you know, with athletics, I think that investment is very apparent and real, and you can see it. Mm-hmm. Like what you and I do every day, we in a way have to be even more conscious about investing in our craft, because we can very easily just go like do the work. But how are we getting better at doing the work? And unless you plan for it, in my view, unless you plan for it and make it part of your day. In alchemy, we talk about that in terms of building the plumbing for the business and for ourselves.
Like, sure.
What are we doing all the time to build the plumbing of the business, to build the plumbing of ourselves, so that we become better over time? And that, I think in sports, as I said, you can see that.
And there's almost an immediate return.
There's an immediate return.
So much of the stuff that you and I will work on and everything is like, I bet this will work, but it takes time to play out.
You don't see
out.
It right yeah. away. Yeah. And it's I think that's the one of the hardest things, I think, in business, is to figure out what that is. There's a few things I've sort of learned over the years. as it relates to me and as a professional, and that I've learned this from other people, that I've seen them do this very well, which is that A, investing in yourself is always the best return, no matter what. That's the best, the top of your list always should be, how can I improve? The other area, I think, is, and something I'm trying to practice now, because I think I'm okay at it, but I could be a lot better at it, and 3 or 4 years ago I was bad at it, which is, how can I see the world for as it really is? Because as an entrepreneur, you have a lot of hope, and you have a lot of like, hey, I wish this would exist, and I can make it exist, but sometimes you fool yourself, mm-hmm. you know, easily. Sometimes you can fool yourself about a customer, like, oh yeah, they're going to buy, and then you realize, well, they didn't, they're never going to buy.
Yeah, just because you think it's something that the world wants and needs doesn't mean that's it right. actually is.
You could be wrong.
Correct.
Quite often you are wrong. And so I think the Uber skill to sort of cultivate is, how can you practice your ability to see things as they are, and not as you want them to be? And maybe sometimes the two are the same, but what should rule should be what is reality. And that I think that I know that when I've made mistakes in business, and I've made lots of them, it's because I fooled myself into thinking something. Occasionally it was because someone truly didn't do what they would say they were going to do. And it's not always because they were bad people. You know, mm-hmm. sometimes whatever happens. But generally speaking, it's because I just didn't have the right view on how things are. And so I think for me, that's what I'm really trying, like, that's my film study and practicing and stretching and running, you know, running mm-hmm. 40s now for me intellectually is, okay, let me practice seeing things as they really are. And I ask myself a lot, like, okay, what makes me believe this? And am I underlying assumptions right? And what data have I maybe selectively chosen to believe, but I've ignored this? And one of the rituals that I do with myself from time to time is sort of take the opposite position to every position I've taken and try to mentally argue that side as, mm-hmm. as vigorously as I can. And quite often I realize, man, I was so wrong about this situation, and you know, I need to change course.
How do you guard, and I think that exercise is critical for all of us to do in really all aspects of our lives, right? Are we, like you said, are the underlying assumptions I'm going into this conversation, this venture, all of that, are they accurate?
Right.
How do you guard that exercise against sort of vapor locking and it turning into indecision?
Such a good question. I think that's a real trap, potential trap. So I think at the end of the day, as an entrepreneur or anyone, I mm-hmm. think you've got to have a bias for action. So there's a time for thinking about something, which is very valuable and important. And there's a time for doing. And doing ultimately yields the results that you're looking for. So I think it's really a question of how do you craft your discipline. So I'll tell you what I do for me, mm-hmm. which is not a prescription for anyone, but it's what I do for me. So I have a ritual usually every Saturday morning, have a journal. I've got it in my backpack right over there. And I write down sort of all the ideas, thoughts, things that we're doing, et cetera. And then I consider which ones really make sense, which ones are working. Like, where's the evidence that's, mm-hmm. like, we're doing this marketing thing. Where's the evidence that it's working? And maybe I really love it, but right, there's right. no evidence that it's working. So either
maybe, maybe it was my idea.
It was my, most time it is my idea.
Right. Yeah.
Like most of the crappy ideas are my ideas.
Well, and those are the ones I love the most.
Exactly.
Mine, right?
They're the best. Yeah. And so, so I look at that list and I really try to consider, you know, which one is really working. And then out of that Saturday morning routine, then I can say, okay, I think these two or three things are validated, or this one is not validated, or I need to dig in mm-hmm. to say, I don't have enough information to really validate it. So then that will land on my next week's to-do list. And the reason I do that on a Saturday morning is because I've found that it's actually like my high energy point during the week.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, where I'm really, the week is kind of, the work week is sort of done most of the time, not always. But that is a time for me to push pause on like my to-do list and to really consider my to-think list. And mm-hmm. so that's a ritual I think that can be helpful, or has been helpful for me. Again, to avoid the vapor loft, to use your phrase, very good phrase, but that's been helpful for me to sort of plow through. And ultimately, I hope that that kind of ritual continues to build me up into mm-hmm. into a pro. And I think I've got a long way to go in that regard. And so it's an important ritual.
So I like the statement that as an entrepreneur or you know a problem solver, your default position has to be toward action.
You're right.
And I think as long as you have that sort of as your North Star, then no matter what you're working on, you can say, you know what, eventually you got to go.
You do have to go.
I used to work with this girl, and she was the most amazing. Like if you had a project that you needed to research, you'd say, hey, Shauna, go look at this. Mm-hmm. She would literally wake up in the morning thinking about it, and she might not show up to work until 1, but it's because she was in her closet floor with the computer writing notes and feverishly looking and just got hung up doing that.
Right.
And her real challenge in all of it was, hey, you know what? At some point, you got to pull the trigger on something, Shauna.
You do.
We can't keep writing
dissertations
about this. You've got to take whatever information you have and go. And I think it's interesting. You mentioned, you may be intentionally doing it, but you're kind of high grading. Is this a valid idea? Is this not?
Yeah.
And it's almost like a scientific method of identifying
what
is good and what needs more evidence to be proven good and what is evidenced not good.
That's right. Yeah. And evidence is the key phrase there. One of the other phrases that Andrew Malik and I, who Andrew's our co-founder in the business, really very talented engineering mind.
I met him and I asked him if he was going to be on it and he said you wouldn't have let him. Maybe you guys can work that out.
He's busy creating amazing stuff for our customers.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, they don't really let me make stuff. And so, you know, that it's a good thing that he's making it. I'm an engineer too, but, you know, Andrew's sort of one of those weird unicorn engineers.
There are levels to this game.
There are levels to this game. He's on a different one. He's like one of those creatures back at LSU. Like, I can't do what he does.
Right.
So one of our phrases is market pull. And we ask ourselves this question all the time, like, okay, no matter what we're doing or thinking or think we're going to do, where in reality is the market pull, i.e., where are they placing orders mm-hmm. with us? Because no matter what, like all the marketing stuff we do or whatever, like this fancy Saturday morning thing that I do, ultimately the market has the upvote on what you've chosen to do.
Right. And that's the ultimate truth.
It's the ultimate truth. And sometimes that's like a wicked truth. Mm-hmm. You know, and I can tell you with Alchemy, we've been around for a very short period of time. We launched in late 2020. We only had a manufacturing facility for about 14 months. So mm-hmm. very short period of time. And in that period of time, I think the fancy phrase is we've run a lot of experiments. The real phrase is we've screwed up a lot. But throughout that process, we realized where is the market pull? Mm. Where are people placing orders? Where's revenue hitting our income statement? And then maybe even more importantly, where are they coming back to get more from us?
Right.
Because that's an upvote on the first thing we did for them. And so. So we're beginning to see that now, and that now is informing, okay, this seems to be working for this kind of a customer. The pricing seems to be in the right spot. You know, delivery, we're able to deliver this and service it. So now our marketing now is like, okay, now let's tell that story more. Because now we're not marketing sort of into the night hoping. We actually have real customers buying real stuff, and mm-hmm. now we're saying, okay, this is what these are the messages that they seem to be connecting with. And I'll tell you this one story, Justin, that just happened this week, and it just made me so happy, like emotionally happy.
Sure.
So we just signed an agreement with a company called Zar Power. They are an EV charging startup and based in Ohio, and we're very grateful that they're choosing Houston as their manufacturing center. And in fact, I'm busy trying to convince Tony Prezzone, the CEO, to come to Houston. So Tony, if you're listening, get your butt here as quickly as possible.
Well, and when he does, we'll do this with him.
Yeah, we should.
That would be cool.
He'll be great. He's a U.S. Army veteran.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, his co-founder is a PhD, MIT, EE, so like really dumb guy.
I mean, every company has those.
That's right, yeah. Like they have to bring him along, like speak slowly, small words. But and so Tony did an introduction for us to someone else that was, mm-hmm. you know, we think is going to be important to us in terms of our growth. And And he wrote an email that, I mean, I couldn't have penned a better marketing email than he did. And I shared it with Andrew. Like, he used some of the phrases that we use internally, and I didn't prompt him. So that is sort of, that's evidence that tells you, here's a customer that is transacting with us, that is using phrases that we aspirationally have been using, you know, kind of in bits and pieces. And this guy wrote a long email that was like, I could cut and paste that into every marketing content and copy that we could use. So that then tells us, okay, let's double down on that. Because this guy is using the words that are really good descriptions of what we want to be for our customers. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's where the evidence comes in ultimately. And that now, like I said, informs us on our marketing positioning, because we know that seems to be getting some traction. Now, it is possible that Tony's the last guy that cares about that, but I don't think so, because we're hearing that from other people too. One of the key things that we talk a lot about internally besides plumbing is friction. And so when I think about businesses and how I interact with businesses, whether it's consumer products or business to business, what bothers me the most is when there's a lot of friction in that relationship. Like, they're hard to use, or it takes a long time, or it's confusing, or, like, you know, I'm halfway through filling out a web form and they're like, they're asking me 17 questions that are not relevant. I'm like, I'm just gonna give up.
I hate those when they start gatekeeping those forms.
Yeah, it's like,
some of it's fine, I get it, but man,
it's too much.
You don't need to know how many kids I got.
No, exactly. Yeah. They're like, what's your favorite color, and where were you,
right?
Yeah, what's your deepest, darkest fear? I'm like, well, you need a bigger web form for that.
Right. Is this how many characters?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so we talk a lot about friction, and we're trying to build alchemy in such a way that we are as lowest friction. We'll never be frictionless, but lowest friction as we possibly can be in every interaction. Mm-hmm. You know, and so Tony used the word friction and low friction in his email intro to the other person. Again, we don't use that word outside of our business. Like, it's an internal thing. Yet he articulated the very thing that we're trying to build. Like, that is, to be honest with you, if you could boil down alchemy into the one value we're trying to create, is we're trying to create a business that can take a product from just post prototype to scale manufacturing as easily and as quickly as possible. That is the thing that we're building. We're not building really anything else. And so, you know, I think that's sort of exhibit A for us, that we've got a customer that is using those words and has joined us because of that. And so that's sort of the not fooling yourself piece of this.
Yeah, that's definitely evidence, right?
It's evidence.
That you're living that value.
And
that's a true core to who Alchemy is, or your company. And the fact that you're not outwardly communicating that, and that person is using it, it means, I think that can only be evidence.
I think so too. And I think it's, you know, I don't think we could ever say, hey, we have a frictionless environment. I think we have to be a frictionless company so that people will, let me turn this on again. Here we go.
I'm going to allow you to do that.
Yeah. We have to be a frictionless company so that people will then use those words to describe what we are. Maybe they won't use friction. Maybe they'll use something else. But
barrier to entry, or, you know,
whatever it is. It's like their language. They'll use whatever their language is to describe that. So the lesson for us was, like, all right, let's keep being that thing which produces that response in our customers. So that gives us work to do internally, and I can name a dozen places where we're, like, really crappy on friction internally, but I can also name a dozen places where we're really good, you know, and maybe one or two where we're, like, close to world class, and primarily because of guys like Andrew, and so, you know, that gives us some direction to really follow.
Yeah, internal friction is family business. That's fine. you want it to appear as smooth as possible.
You do.
To everyone. And the flip side of that is when people stop using that phrase to describe you, you know that you're off the mark.
That's right, right? Yeah. And ultimately they vote with their dollars and their
correct
feet,
you know. So when did you start your first business?
Well, so my career has been a mix of starting things and then also coming in and running things for other people. So I think my first true startup was actually within another operating company. And this is probably my first true startup, like outside of an operating company.
Okay.
But so I think my chops are really around growing businesses of different kinds. Startups, I think, are really, really difficult to do. And I've had enough experience now to do them, but or to try to do them. So my first, I think this is really my first true legitimate startup.
Alchemy. You mean alchemy?
Yeah, and I've done like consulting things before.
Sure.
But I don't know if I consider those even businesses, but could have been turned into one, but
sure,
didn't end up being. So my experience with growing companies really began, or growing anything really began when I was a baby engineer, like 23 or 24 years old, and I was put into a group. My first job, which was a downstream chemical company, I was put into a group that was the first reliability engineering group at this facility. So I had to start that up, and I had no idea what I was doing. I was
right.
A 23-year-old idiot.
Well, and that was before you could Google it.
It was before you could Google it, yeah. And the revolutionary IT, information technology was email. You know, we were all trying to figure out, well, what is this email thing? You know, how, you know, why is it even necessary?
Right.
At least it'll never amount to anything.
I remember when text messaging became a thing.
Yeah.
And I was like, why would you ever do that?
I know.
You just call a guy. And now I'm like, oh, why is somebody calling me now?
Yeah. You don't like it when someone calls you.
Right. That's right.
So that was really the first time. And that's where I began to appreciate and love starting something, and appreciate and love being comfortable like in a blank sheet of paper. And mm-hmm. I still am. I still love that. And to build something from the ground up, or to take something that is sort of like condition A and turn it into condition B, I love that, and I love the living in a complex environment and simplifying it. I think there's tremendous value for any professional to be able to simplify that which is complicated, and sometimes it's not that difficult to do. Like, you know, hey, you know, you're ordering something for lunch, and in your office, and people always struggle with like going through all these multiple menus, and you know, like we all have that in our mm-hmm. office environments. Maybe you're the person that helps to organize that to make it easier
right.
to use. It might not be a business, but you've created value, you know, and
right.
so I think a lot of value can come from making things simple that were complicated. So that's what I learned how to do over and over again. And then I began to learn how to sort of construct teams around problems too. And after making lots of mistakes, have realized that a team of people is really sort of this collection of talents. And the talents not only have to interact with each other really well, but that they have to together serve a purpose of solving that problem, whichever problem you've chosen to solve. So like in alchemy, as I mentioned, friction, the people that we're beginning to hire, we're looking for that. Like, can you help us build that? And you know, what is your background, your skill set, your talent? They can help take that complicated, friction-filled step and make it easier. And so building teams around problems to solve a specific problem, I began to learn how to do that at a very early stage in my career. And it is true to say that that was all luck. The opportunities were luck.
Mm-hmm.
And I had people that seemed old to me at the time that were my age now, that they gave me those opportunities.
Right.
Like a baby engineer, you know, like 98% idiot and 2% something, some other creature.
Right, right.
You know, and so...
Less idiot.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, precisely. And so I had people early on in my career who said, Mush, go do this.
Yeah.
You know,
yep.
And for whatever reason, they said that. And so... that gave me lots of opportunities to do that. And I had some along the way as I was learning to sort of construct teams and take on problems, et cetera, that now help me today. I had some like monumental screw ups. Like mm-hmm. I am talking spectacular, I should have been fired screw ups. And one of my favorite stories is, one of these experiences, I think I was in my early 20s, still like maybe 24 years old, and I had a project to replace a heat exchanger that's on the side of a distillation column. And anyone that's been in the refinery or the chemical plant environment knows what I'm talking about. And so these are heat exchangers that sit like they're connected to on the side of a distillation column mm-hmm. vertically. And so it was a shutdown, there was a leak, and so this section of the plant had to be taken down so that we could remove this heat exchanger, do the repairs, and put it back. Okay, so it was my job to handle the repairs. And
right.
So I made a mistake in some measurements. Okay, and so this heat exchanger went out for like 3 days to get its repairs, and it came back. And keep in mind, the economic penalty was like hundreds of thousands of dollars per hour.
Sure,
like, this
sure.
is like...
You're burning cash.
You are burning cash. And so, and like the CEO of the company knows, you know, D2220's heat exchanger is out. You know,
he's getting briefed on when that's back online.
Right, yeah. He's wondering, like, what idiot did they give this job
right.
to? Well, that was me.
Yeah, what's a mush?
What's a mush? Yep. Yeah. Yeah. We shouldn't even be employing something called mush. Yeah. So I had this job, and so I mismeasured, okay? And so this heat exchanger came back. And so, you know, distillation column, like if your listeners and viewers can imagine it, you've got two flanges, and then you've got the heat exchanger has to made up mm-hmm. those flanges. So, you know, brought it in, and like, and it was like an inch off. So it may as well be a mile off.
Yeah, you can't just put a screwdriver in the bolt holes.
That was not happening. Yeah, it's so, like Schedule 80 pipe. You were not screwdrivering
right.
this
That's
thing
right.
in.
You're not going to make that work.
No. And so like an inch off. And so, you know, so down it comes and out it goes. And
yeah, it's basically restart that whole thing. Yeah.
Story gets better. So comes back. So this time instead of...
Better is an interesting word. But
Yeah. So like it was like... Instead of this, it was the other side.
No.
Yeah, I screwed up like in reverse. So not technically the same mistake. But it was like the opposite of the mistake I made.
Is the picture negative of the mistake?
It was. Yeah. So the guy I worked for at the time.
First of all, that's what engineers do. What you just did.
What's that?
That's not the same mistake.
No, that's right.
It's the exact same mistake. You know?
Yeah. No. Almost
that's completely
adjusted. Yeah.
Different.
Come on.
It's a completely different.
Let's
mistake.
Remain technical here. So
yeah, I apologize.
Yes, that's okay. And so, like all the engineers out there, like Mush is right.
Yeah, no, he's absolutely right about
absolutely
that.
Absolutely right. Yeah.
Yep.
And so, yeah, he's wrong in magnitude the same way, but in direction not. You know,
so it's completely different.
So those vector geeks out there. So like Ralph Villeman, who was the maintenance manager at the time, mm-hmm. he was like 6'3", 6'4", like John Wayne,
just
Texas.
An imposing human.
Oh God, I was so intimidated by Ralph. So intimidated.
But you were a kicker for LSU. How is that possible?
It's hard to believe that a kicker would be intimidated by anything. You know, it really
true.
Is.
Yeah.
That's
true.
But because we're a haughty bunch.
Yeah, you know? That's right.
Well,
you
like,
played football at LSU, man.
Well, yeah. I'm like, if you want a hill stormed, you just send in the kickers. You know.
Well, you guys have stamina for days.
We have stamina for days, like on one leg though.
Yeah, of course.
Like,
right.
We hop
right.
up those hills. So. Like, and if there's a football on top of that hill, by golly, we will kick it.
You'll kick it
we'll
off kick the hill.
Off the hill. And that's then, right. like, you know, scamper back down as quickly as possible.
Frolic
even.
Down the hill.
Yeah, gallivant even on some days. And so.
On a good day.
And so so Ralph calls me, like, on the radio. So we have these implant radios.
Right.
He's like, Mush, what's your 20? I'm like, oh, crap, this is not good. Ralph is calling me. Like, what's your 20 means what's your location.
Yeah, where are you?
But what he meant was, come here now.
That's right.
Yeah. So,
wherever you are,
right.
Be here
like now.
Now.
And so I you know, traveled over there on my little plant bicycle, and then he lets me know what the problem is, and he gives me the biggest public dressing down I've ever experienced in my life. And this was like this was like, you couldn't do it today, but you know, he used some choice words about my background.
It was 100% deserved.
100% deserved, yeah. Like, yeah, really well deserved. And so, and it really was. It was a complete, it was not, here's what I should have done. I should have had someone who was used to taking these measurements, take the measurements. But I was too damn arrogant.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, no, I can do it. Well, it's just a tape measure. You know, I can mm-hmm. operate a tape measure. Couldn't obviously
clearly not
yeah right. And so I made a mistake there, and so he gave me a massive dressing down, and you know, kind of like went to the core of my existence, you know. So you know, I was like, whatever sort of arrogance was in me at the time,
he took care of that.
Yeah, like sword went in, out came the arrogance,
right?
And so And Ralph was, if you can believe it, I think he did what was necessary for me, you know, in that moment in time. He knew what he was doing. He was a very, very smart guy.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, he was a guy from Pasadena, and he, you know, was brilliant in so many different ways. And so, because we have a lot of brilliant people working in these plants and working in manufacturing, maybe they don't have college degrees or mm-hmm. anything else, but they know stuff. They know stuff. Technically, philosophically, life-wise, you know, that
they are very, very smart people.
Well, this is what they, I think you're right, and I think it's also what you and I were talking about earlier, like they see reality in ways that quite often people like me don't see, because they deal with it every single day. It's
right.
Like constantly with them,
right.
I can be in my office and, you know, pretend all kinds of things, but these guys are dealing with like energy in their face.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
That's right.
So literally energy. And so Ralph gave me this dressing down, and I was just like completely wrecked, you know. I think the lowest point in my life, literally. And
not just your professional life.
This is it.
I'd
never experienced anything like that, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I had sort of demanding parents in a sense, but never like anything like that. No one had ever really yelled at me. And, you know, I was like this,
in a public setting.
Like, if you can imagine like 200 guys, you know, all in Nomex coveralls.
Oh, yeah.
And just like, they're all turned in, like looking at me.
Yeah. Well, it's a show.
It's a show. Yeah. And the show was on, baby.
And they weren't a part of it, and they were happy about that.
They were happy. Like, thank God it's him.
Yeah.
Thank God. Like, that kid had it coming.
Yeah.
So, and I did. And so that wrecked me. So I kind of like slouched back. There was no frolicking involved in that case. But
no, definitely no gallivanting.
No gallivanting. Like, I wouldn't dare gallivant.
No, it's not the time.
No, that's right. No tomfoolery. None of that stuff. So I'm sitting in my trailer, and this was back when you could have a trailer in an operating environment. Now you wouldn't do that for safety reasons, but back then you could. Mm-hmm. And well, back then you didn't know you couldn't. And so, you know, people did it. And so so I'm sitting there. By now it's like 7 o'clock in the evening, and everyone's gone. And you know, I'm like, oh man, I'm getting fired. I just know it. What am I going to tell my parents? You know, all this stuff. And so the door opens to the trailer, and I hear footsteps. I'm like, well, here it comes. Here comes the firing.
That's right.
You
know.
And so Doug Mathera, who was the plant manager, came in, and Doug was, I think, like the son of a West Virginia coal miner, and didn't say a lot. You know, when he spoke, he, like, those words were, like, really went through you.
He was very efficient.
He was very efficient with his words, that's right. And so Doug came in, and he looked at me, and like, slouched in my chair, and he's like, what's going on, Khan? And he never called me my first name. He always called me Khan, just to be extra imposing.
Sure, yeah.
You know, and so and I told him what happened, and, of course, you know, he absolutely knew.
He knew what happened.
Yeah, for sure. He knew the first time, and he definitely knew the second time.
Right.
You know, so he probably heard Ralph yelling from his office at me. So I told him, and Doug could see I was clearly upset. And Doug, and this is such sort of a dichotomy of experiences, and as I think about it, like, this was beautifully designed for me at the time.
Right.
So we had Ralph, who gave me a dressing down.
Mm-hmm.
But not with malice, if you can believe that, but it was the appropriate dressing down, like at level 10.
Mm-hmm.
And then Doug comes in and he looks at me, and I still remember. So Doug used to chew tobacco and spit into a styrofoam cup, like ubiquitous in some of these places.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and so
I think by law they have to have at least one of those guys.
By law, it's legal. Not only is it legal, it's like a good idea.
It's a great idea.
Right. And so he looks at me, like, just shakes his head and, you know, spits into the cup. And he said, don't worry, I'd buy Khan stock. That's all he said, you know. And so, and that immediately, I had like the rush of confidence. Like, here's a guy who I just absolutely admired and respected and worshipped in many ways, saying that he would buy Khan stock. Like, he would buy stock in me. And the message that he was telling me at that time is like, hey man, you're down, but I'm a buyer of you.
Yeah.
You know, I'm an investor in you.
Yeah.
And so in that 15 minute period of time of just, you know, this absolute sort of gut-wrenching dressing down by Ralph and then Doug coming in and saying this to me was one of the most, maybe the most transformative experience and that I've had in my career. And I've always learned that. I've always taken that lesson forward when I've had the opportunity to lead people, not to dress them down. I would never do that. But the importance of, betting on people and helping them grow for their own right, in their own right, was vital. And so, Doug and Ralph, wherever they may be now, I think in many ways, outside of my parents, mm-hmm. were the two people that I think deserve the most credit for almost anything that I've accomplished since that time. And there've been other people too. Another guy by the name of John Casper, who was also sort of in that period of time, was also very influential on me. But I can't believe how lucky I was in those early experiences that people would take the time to dress me down, to care enough.
Yep.
Because what Ralph was really doing was like, you can be much better than you were in this moment. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to deliver to you the biggest ass whipping I can publicly mm-hmm. because of that. It didn't feel like that at the time.
No, it never does.
Never does. But as I think back, and as I have thought back about that experience a lot, that's really what it was. And so I think a lot of people would be lucky to have those experiences that I did, and I was was given those experiences. I didn't create them.
Sure, and you're sure he didn't mean like Conn's Electronics?
He could have meant that. I mean, that really has like crushed this entire multi-decade vision I have now. So now that you mention it, maybe he was like being literal in a different way. So
yeah,
thanks.
Well, yeah, sorry
there
about
goes
that.
There goes my confidence. Well. I'm shutting alchemy down. That's right. It.
Well, you're welcome, I guess.
Yeah. Good success. Yeah. Successful podcast. Another yeah. business crushed and another soul decimated.
the alternate reason I started this.
Right.
All joking aside, I think it's important lesson for anyone out there that leads teams, yeah. not just has businesses that they run.
Sure.
To in some ways embrace that uncomfortable conversation. If
right.
you've got a and I will say that only applies to someone that you have a great deal of belief in.
I think so too. Yeah.
If it's somebody that's just, man, they just aren't on the same wavelength.
Right.
That's a different, difficult conversation, but it's not someone that you're willing to invest mm-hmm. an ass chewing in
that's
or,
right.
Time out of your day to make sure they understand, hey, we love you
mm-hmm.
and you really dicked this up, but mm-hmm. we mm-hmm. love you
that's
and
right.
you're better than that. We expect more out of you. And
sure.
because we expect more out of you, you're going to be here.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's so good. That's so true. I think that's a great observation that it's, you're sort of calling someone to a higher standard mm-hmm. because you see that the capability is in there. Maybe it's rough or it's not developed or whatever, but the raw materials are there.
Mm-hmm.
And
and maybe in your case at that time, it was underdeveloped because you were a young man.
I didn't have the experience. I didn't
right.
have the
That's
confidence
right.
to seek help.
That's
you
right.
know, I was too arrogant to seek help.
And it's interesting you say the confidence to seek help.
Mm-hmm.
That really it does take a level of security with yourself.
It does.
To be able to say, hey, man, will you check my numbers?
That's right.
And
yeah.
and if they check out wrong, go, man, I'm glad you did that.
Yeah, it's kind of like what we were talking about earlier about trying to see reality. Sometimes
mm-hmm.
the reality is that I don't know. I just don't have the experience or I don't have the vision or, I've never really worked on this before. So, right now we're working on some relatively complex investment opportunities and financial structures, et cetera. And like I have Wikipedia level knowledge of that
sure.
kind of stuff, so I'm seeking help to help me navigate through that because I don't want to screw it up because I was too dumb to realize how dumb I was.
Yeah.
On that
yeah.
point.
And I wouldn't say too dumb to realize how dumb. It really would just boil down to honestly an arrogance in
That's
my
right.
in my mind.
Yeah.
It's I'm Justin. I started this thing. I need to know all of the answers.
Yeah.
And no one can.
No one can. I think that I would say that like if and I've given this advice to young people before in whatever profession is that they are, when they're entering the workforce, they have a golden period of time where everyone expects them to be an idiot, and that you should take advantage mm-hmm. of that. Like, say, I don't know as much as you can, because people will rush in to help.
Absolutely.
They will rush to help. I think that's a universal truth. Every now and then you find someone who's just an asshole and they won't help you, but that's like maybe 1 out of 1,000 times that's going
to
happen.
Yeah, my experience with those people is that it generally boils down to some sort of an insecurity on their part.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
and
that's
so
right.
If you can ever kind of breach that insecurity, they mm-hmm. a lot of times can be some of the most help.
That's right, yeah. And I think even today, Justin, that even with customers, you know, and I've got a ton of experience, but what's been the most effective for me is to be open and vulnerable with customers and to have real conversations. We were having a conversation yesterday on a subject with a customer that we've just won called Urban Electric Power, UEP. They're a battery cell manufacturer, and we're taking their cells and turning them into a variety of products. And we were sort of navigating through the next stage in our business relationship. And what I loved about this conversation was that we sort of had two different views on how to do something next. But it was a great conversation, because we were like, okay, this is what I think, this is what you think. I think in that moment, because both of us were open and vulnerable, we were striving for a third better idea. Hmm. Like, you know, I sent him a proposal, like a straw man on something. They considered it and were talking to me about, well, you know, we're okay with this, not sure, don't know about this, can't do that. But we left that conversation, not with an agreement, but we're like, okay, you know, let's keep talking. And we could both sort of see a third better idea emerging from that conversation.
It was a combination of things.
Yeah, it was a combination of things. And that I think it took both of us to be open and vulnerable to have that conversation. So like kind of it's another version of being saying, I don't know. Mm-hmm. You know, this. Let me start out. Let me go first by pitching an idea. But it's not a, this is it no matter what. This is a, let me get something going and get something on paper, knowing that the final idea might be like 1% of what I put on that paper. Mm-hmm. But there is value in going first and putting some stake in the ground. It's a loose stake, but a stake in the ground. And that one of the things I've learned is that the partners that you choose, the employees, the people that you bring in, the raw materials have to be there, even with customers.
Sure.
You know, like, can we collaborate with a customer? Because if we can't, then it's the relationship has already ended. The timing has not arrived yet.
Right.
But it's going to end.
Your strive to be a frictionless provider is going to be only friction at that
point. That's right. It's not going to be only friction. And they're going to hate us.
Right.
You know,
right. And you're going to be hating them.
Yeah. And you don't want that.
So what you're describing is just vulnerability, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
As an entrepreneur, there's so many points that you're vulnerable.
Sure.
How do you mentally get through the fact that, okay, hey, I'm kind of putting it all out there right
yeah.
now.
Yeah.
And I think it's going to work, but it might not work. But how do you get comfortable being vulnerable mm-hmm. and kind of taking that next step? How do you do that?
That's such a good question. I'll give you sort of a Marvel movies reference to the answer. And so
you've already talked to the Vector nerds, so they're probably
all leaning in now. Yeah,
if you get some Star Wars in there, we'll
dude,
be good.
I have a Star Wars reference, epic one, just wait,
it's coming.
If we go deep, I'm gonna pull out that Star Wars reference. It has to do with the Force.
Oh, well,
you're gonna love it.
I'll do my best to get
teaser.
Us there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we'll have to gallivant our way there. And so maybe even meander
potentially.
That's right. And so one of the movies where it was the first movie, I think, where there was an attack on New York and all the Avengers were like in the street and fighting the people coming through the, you know, the portal or whatever it was. And so so the Bruce Banner arrives on his motorcycle mm-hmm. I promise you this is going somewhere.
Oh, I have no doubt.
so Bruce Banner.
And that was called The Avengers, was the name of the movie.
The Avengers. Yeah, hashtag Avengers. Yeah, so.
So we get some Marvel merch sent.
Exactly. We should. I mean, like, there's some serious product placement that could happen here.
Yeah.
So I think Thor asks him or tells him, like, hey, it's time to turn into the Hulk mm-hmm. and, you know, time to get angry. And so Bruce Banner's like, my secret is I'm always angry.
Right.
So I would say this, in terms of how to handle or how I handle that vulnerability, is that I recognize that I'm never not nervous in those kinds of situations where there may be a conflict coming, or there may be, you know, a difficult conversation, mm-hmm. or whatever. You know, I think it's okay to be all nervous and tongue-tied and worried and have, you know, like your stomach's in knots or you're sweating or whatever, like however your body
responds to that. Yeah,
it's going to happen, and we're all humans and we're all going to be that way, and believe me, the person on the other side of the conversation is probably feeling that way too. Mm-hmm. And so I think that the more in business, if you've picked the right partners, if you pick the wrong partners, this is a disastrous strategy, mm-hmm. that I'm about to say. But if you pick the right partners, if you're open and vulnerable and even use the words like, hey, I'm not really sure about this, or, you know, I'm worried about talking to you about this because I'm not sure how it's going to go or how are you going to respond. I think if you pick the right partners, then you can have those kinds of conversations, and then ultimately you more than likely will arrive at a good point. It doesn't guarantee that you will.
Sure.
And weirdly, I think the more you can be that way, the more relaxed you'll end up having that conversation, and you'll have like a real conversation, like two potential partners or actual partners, and there becomes a sort of a collective realization, like there's an opportunity to build something really good here between these two groups,
right.
or these two people. And I think you can only arrive at it if you are as open as you possibly can be. If you pick the wrong partners, you'll get railroaded and overrun, steamrolled, pick your metaphor, you know,
right.
you'll
right.
lose. And so you've got to be super cautious about that, but
yeah.
worth trying.
Yeah, absolutely. And that vulnerability, I think for me, I just started learning this later in life, right? And I'm 46, so I'm not old by any stretch of the imagination, mm-hmm. but at the same time, it took me longer than I feel like it should to learn that if I'm vulnerable more than I'm not,
yeah,
then I get more comfortable being vulnerable,
sure,
and more capable in vulnerable situations.
That's right.
So
yeah.
it's just kind of like, you know, it's an exercise, right? And,
mm-hmm.
and you just have to get yourself there. Being an entrepreneur is not going to have any shortage of opportunities to practice being vulnerable. So.
Yeah. I'd like to add one other thing on
sure.
vulnerability, Justin. I think there's another word for it, which may be openness. And I think maybe vulnerability for some people may have a negative connotation of some kind. Or
sure.
like, I don't want to be vulnerable. And I get it. I do get that. But openness is maybe another way of describing it, which is, are you open to a different kind of experience?
Correct.
You know, and maybe that's a better way at arriving at a conversation, and you don't have to commit to anything.
Sure.
You can at least be open to like, what really is that person saying? It may be ultimately something I don't agree with, or I can't
right.
do, or
right.
it's not economical or whatever, but can you be open to them in such a way? Because then I think people will tell you really what's on mm-hmm. their mind. In my experience with negotiations, it's almost never, people are almost never telling you what they really want.
Right.
So then we all spend too much time, months sometimes, just like
it's a game.
It's a game. When at the end of that period, you're like, that's what you were worried about.
Yeah, we could have done that 2 months
yeah,
ago.
Yeah, I wish. But I think if you take, I would like to take responsibility of being open enough to where the other person really tells me mm-hmm. what they want. Because in some cases, it may end up being a no. You just want that no as soon as you possibly can, so you don't waste a ton of time trying to get to that.
Sure.
No.
You know, I think it's interesting you bring that up, especially on the negotiation side. It made me think of an exercise that I did. I went to a leadership course on negotiation and mm-hmm. stuff, and it was held by the Cox School of Business at SMU.
Oh, great.
And it was great.
Yeah.
And I remember the exercise was, you know, we had a contract with a customer, and the customer was basically saying, we're not paying
mm-hmm.
that. And how do you go in and negotiate?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And all the groups went in, and our group went in, and I said, we're going to go in and tell them that they're contractually bound to it, and they're going to pay it in
mm-hmm.
full.
Mm-hmm.
And the guys were like, really? I was like, yeah, we're doing that. So we went in and we did that, and the instructor goes, in all of the times we've done this, we've never had anyone do that.
Yeah.
And I said, well, at the very least, they're going to come back and say, well, we'll only pay 60% of it
right.
or whatever. You're still getting
something.
Right now they're saying zero.
Right.
But if you go in and say you have a contract, and that's, again, getting back to your point, and I think openness is the correct word.
Right.
But there's a lot of vulnerability in being open. There's a lot of, because it could go horribly wrong.
It could, but I think in that case, like, there was a contract. And,
correct.
You know, yeah. And you should be able to say, look, we've got a deal, and we've mm-hmm. we've documented it.
Well, and, so. And my thought there was, you have a contract, and if they're willing to, you know, sort of balk at what the language in that contract says, what do we have to lose?
That's right. Yeah. And you might discover by taking that approach that there's a way to navigate through it. You know, can they pay you differently? Can they pay you over time?
Right.
Whatever the case might be. But I think the openness part is like being open enough to say, we've got a deal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we both signed it in mm-hmm. good faith. And so that's our starting point.
Right. You know? That's right. So that's ground zero. Let's work from there. So,
right.
You're being open, you're doing those things, you start, you decide, man, I've my career so far has been working inside organizations, building organizations up for various reasons. And you said, I think I can do this.
Mm-hmm.
So very much like other conversations I've had with entrepreneurs, it's like all these life experiences are putting puzzle pieces together, and
right.
eventually something gets put in place that you're like, I'm in.
Yeah.
What was that for you?
Yeah, I think a similar journey for me.
Mm-hmm.
Not really like one, you know, one period of revelation or moment of revelation. It really was enough experiences being connected with each other where I really thought it was time to start Alchemy. So the experiences for me were over a period of years where, you know, I've always been in like manufacturing or distribution, industrial stuff. Like that's all I've ever done.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely had lots of experience along those lines. But in sort of the mid, like the 2014, 2015 timeframe, I began really looking deeper into manufacturing and how things are made and supply chains and outsourcing to places like China, et cetera. I ran a company that had its supply chain in China, so spent some time in China working with the contract factories that mm-hmm. we had over there. And so during that experience, I began to notice something happening. Every time I went back to China, labor rates were higher.
Mm-hmm.
And there was also turnover in employees. And so in you know, beginning of the year, there's Chinese New Year. And so a lot of workers that have come in from the center of China during Chinese New Year may go back to their home villages and towns, et cetera. And not all of them come back. And so
right.
So companies have some turnover, so it requires retraining. And then then labor rates were continuing to go up and climb, which I think is really good for like Chinese middle class.
Sure.
But so that dynamic was beginning to happen. The second, and there were three dynamics that I noticed. The second dynamic was and is that a certain manufacturing technology was beginning to get democratized. It was beginning to become usable for like an everyday engineer mm-hmm. or manufacturing professional. So like robotics, 3D printing, AI, machine learning.
Sure.
10
sure.
years ago, you had to code that. Like mm-hmm. you couldn't, there was not a low code solution anywhere. And so, but now, beginning 2-3 years ago, those solutions were being designed so they could be used by sort of mere mortals.
And right, like almost consumer level.
That's right.
Type
yeah,
of work.
Yeah. So like, for example, my very first experience with a real cobot, a collaborative robot, was with a company called Universal Robotics, an amazing product line that they have. And so the salesperson, this was like in 2017, I think it was, the salesperson came in and put this version of a cobot on the table. And he's like, okay, Moshe, I want you to program that. I'm like, I don't know how to program a robot. And so I'm like, look, dude, I went to LSU. You know, so yeah they didn't teach us about technology in engineering school.
We don't need technology around here.
No way. And so... And so I can barely speak English. And so
yeah, imagine that poor girl.
Yeah,
she
exactly.
couldn't at all.
If she's listening now, she's probably horrified.
And yeah, so, she doesn't understand what we're saying, so it's okay.
She doesn't. No, she doesn't. That's right. Yeah. This is English.
Yeah, so, just for the record.
Right.
Yeah.
and so he's like, no, just believe, trust me. And so he handed me an iPad, and like my hand slipped into the strap behind the iPad mm-hmm. to where my index finger was like perfectly positioned above a button. So it was intuitive for me, like, that's a button I push.
Right.
And there was, on the screen, there was a little arrow that said, push this button. Okay. So I pushed the button. Okay. And then another instruction that said, grab the end of the robot and guide it to, while holding the button down, guide it to where you want it to go. So I push the button down, move that end of the robot. And he said, now release. And the instruction then said, release the button.
Mm-hmm.
So I released it. And then it said, like, execute or whatever command was. I pressed it. And that robot did what I did. So now that's an example of, like, now it's using, like, intuitive human skills to program a robot.
Right.
Now, I am sure the really brilliant engineers at Universal made that happen by writing lots of code.
Whenever I have something like that, like a little drone or something, I calibrate it, and I do it just by picking it up, spinning it around, doing whatever my phone told me to do.
Mm-hmm.
I always think there is an insane amount of work
there
that went into making that. That's as easy
right.
as it is for me.
Yeah, and so that insane amount of work was happening mm-hmm. in the area of manufacturing technology to make things like robotics, as I described, or other technologies accessible and usable,
mm-hmm.
you know, without like a big R&D budget, which, like, if you're a shop in Pasadena, Texas, you're not R&Ding your way to anything.
You're not going
to
get R&D. You're not going to hire some, you know, MIT graduate to come code stuff for you. You can't do that.
No, that's not your business. Your business
correct.
Is to make stuff. You know?
That's correct.
So, you know, and so and you should get paid for that. And so, so that was sort of dynamic number two. The third dynamic was and is that I think that there's a tremendous amount of manufacturing demand that is developing around the planet and over time, like over the next 2 decades, I think, maybe 3 decades. And so I'll give you one sort of data point around that. There's something like 3 billion people on the planet that today, in 2022, still burn wood for fuel and for heating. 3 billion people.
Wow.
Billion. That's spectacular. One third of the planet.
That's an insane number.
It's an insane number. And so and we don't always think about that because of where we live here in the U.S. or if you live in the West somewhere. So that's.
I mean, even your parents had a light bulb.
Even
sometimes.
Had a light bulb, yeah. And a lot of these people don't even have a light bulb.
Right, they're using torches.
Yeah, exactly.
To walk around the house.
Right. Yeah, and so, so to imagine this group of people, let's say imagine 10% of that 3 billion people beginning to consume at the per capita GDP that we consume at here in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So that's 300 million people. That's a whole nother America of consumption. That's only
and that's just 10% of it.
And yeah. There'll be way more than 10%.
Sure.
Over time. And so in looking at that data, I thought, holy smokes, someone has to make all the stuff for this group of people that are beginning to join the world economy in a way that we've been enjoying here for a very long time. And what could stop them? Well, maybe there's a few things like wars and political instability, et cetera. But over time, you know, they're empowered now in a way that they haven't been in human history. They carry a smartphone in their hand that gives them access to information, banking, like the levers of growth are beginning to get seeded and being democratized.
And they're accelerating.
So I thought, like, it's inevitable that the world's going to need a lot more stuff. It's going to need more light bulbs and chairs and cars and bicycles and, you know, light bulbs.
Yeah,
one single light bulb.
More of all.
And so, so I thought, okay, well, what are these three dynamics? The idea of increasing labor costs in places like China and other places, sort of the traditional low labor rate economies, those are going up. Dynamic number two was this manufacturing technology. Dynamic number three was 3 billion people, many of whom are going to buy real stuff one
day. Right.
So with that, I thought, gosh, I think generational. And then I try to marry it up to, like, what do I know? What's my experience set? Where are my connections and in network? And where am I credible, you know, if I needed to go raise money? So I thought manufacturing was a place to really go mm-hmm. deep into. and that I thought, well, okay, but it also has to be a different kind of a manufacturing business. It has to be this sort of low-friction manufacturing business that has to... It has to have, like, native leverage of these kinds of technologies and automation mm-hmm. and mindset and all this other stuff. And so ultimately, I thought it was best to start something from the ground up. So even though startups are very difficult, I thought it would be more difficult to transform an existing business, and I tried. I used to own a machine shop, and it just ultimately became too difficult to transform that. So that was sort of the genesis of Alchemy, and it was like a 4-slide PowerPoint that I pitched to a good friend in a family office here, and thank goodness he believed in the thesis. We had literally zero customers. We had zero even target customers. Mm-hmm. Like we were like, hey, business plan is we're going to go make shit.
Yeah, and we're going to do it low friction.
Low friction.
And we're going to start it in the middle of COVID because that's a great time
but
to do it.
Why not? Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, and so yeah, make things as hard as they possibly can. And so
that way when all that stuff doesn't exist anymore, it's easy.
It's easy. Yeah. That was the plan.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well-oiled machine. So
brilliant, honestly.
Yeah, I'd like to think so. And so and so that's what led to it. So now what in these last 14, 15 months that we've actually been in operation, the way it's evolved is that we've this goes back to like where are people paying us and where's the evidence mm-hmm. for what we're doing. So there's two sort of market verticals that we've begun to get some success in very, very early, but begun to get success in. And success that is worth, you know, doubling down into.
This is a real vertical for us to live in.
It's a real vertical. And so, I've got more confidence to spend more money in these areas.
Sure.
So one of them is in this world of industrial automation, which is really the devices and machines that extend human capability in the industrial environment. So, A, we don't have enough humans to build everything that needs to be built. Mm-hmm. And sadly, our young people are not joining the manufacturing world. I wish they would, but you know they're not in big enough numbers. So there's a real labor problem. Everybody knows there's a labor shortage. I believe the manufacturing labor shortage is a 3-decade long problem.
You mean it'll take 3 decades to solve, or it took 3 decades to get here?
Both.
Okay.
It probably took 5 decades to get here, but it's going to take 3 decades to solve because it's all demographics. And, you know, you look at Gen Z, which is now just entering the workforce. It's not a very big generation. So the solution is probably not going to come from that workforce. It's probably going to come from their kids eventually. Mm-hmm. And so this is going to be a problem. Labor is going to be a problem for multiple decades. Now, you compound that in the U.S. and in the Houston area in particular by massive reshoring that is just now happening.
Right.
Because of that dynamic, number one, cheap labor no longer really exists. Mm-hmm. And so people are beginning to figure out, we really need to make stuff here. And the pandemic has...
And reshoring refers to bringing manufacturing
Back into the U.S. And so... So that low labor rate combined with all the disruptions in the supply chain that are happening primarily because of COVID right now are giving people a lot of religion on making stuff here. Mm-hmm. You know, and so you can't, so a lot more stuff is going to be made here. You don't have enough labor. So what's the solution? Well, technology has to enable the humans that we do have to make this increasing demand. So that's one vertical. So those are things like robotics and drones and sensors. We're doing a project, as you saw in our shop, on that has to do with machine vision and AI.
And those were the cameras and all that.
Those are the cameras, yeah. And so we've learned a lot about like machine vision and AI and machine learning as a result of working on that project. We're learning a lot about sensors and how they get ruggedized in an industrial environment. And you know, we've got a drone customer that is just beginning with us that we're learning a lot about. You know, how do those systems work? And what's fascinating about all of those is that the real hard work is the human-to-machine interface. Mm-hmm. How can we make that frictionless?
Right.
Just like that universal robotics engineer solved a big problem for, you know, someone like me, what can we do to solve that interface problem? And so that's one vertical that we're beginning to have success in. The second vertical has to do with electrification. So, you know, obviously a lot of the world is electrifying. Mm-hmm. So we've won...
And electrifying, you're talking like EV cars and things like that?
It could be EVs. It could be, you know, powering our homes with battery systems, other forms of mobility, you know, whatever the case might be. It's really more storage than anything else and some charging capabilities.
Capturing that electricity to be used at a later time.
Yeah, no matter how it's generated.
Sure.
You know, being able to capture that energy. And so... So two customers that we've won there that we've announced publicly already. One of them is, I mentioned earlier, Urban Electric Power. So we're building, we're taking their cell chemistry and building products from them, as I mentioned. And then the second one that we just announced yesterday is Czar Power, and they're an EV charging business. One of the things that makes me proud about both of those wins for us is that both of those companies are not in Texas. UEP is in New York, and Czar Power is in Ohio, but they've chosen Houston as their manufacturing base and us. And so
what do you attribute that to?
Oh, God. I mean, I think, well, I'll tell you that not from my words. I'll tell you from what the UEP team told me when they came to Houston. Mm-hmm. They had no idea as to what is available here in Houston.
Literally everything.
Literally everything. And it was, so the city, the very city was our sales pitch.
That's awesome.
You know, it was, and Houston, and I was having this conversation earlier with someone that is part of the Greater Houston Partnership over lunch today, and she and I were both kind of chuckling about how Houston, we're not great at sort of telling our story. I think that's cultural. We're not braggers, I think, by nature. We're doers. But sometimes the, you got to tell the story of what we can do. But ultimately, I think the UEP team came down and they saw what Houston is all about. Just the, you know, everything from the facilities that are available to the support from the people like the Greater Houston Partnership, and they've been incredible working with us, other business leaders, financial partners or potential financial partners, etc. You know, like, it's all here. And so I would say, you know, if another Houstonian is listening, especially in manufacturing, I'd say go tap into that, those resources. Just like when I screwed up the heat exchanger, my mistake was not asking for help. But now I'm asking for help, and it's here. It's all here. Maybe you have to do a little bit of work to organize it.
Yeah, you know, or to tell the story.
To tell the story, and you know, that's fine. You got to learn how to do that. But I think we're lucky because Houston does sell itself. I think we can do a lot more of that. Mm-hmm. I am so incredibly bullish on Houston in particular, Texas for sure, but on Houston in particular because of the infrastructure we have to make stuff. And this science sounds so hyperbolic, maybe it is, but I think that the manufacturing capacity in the United States is gonna double over the next 2-3 decades or so. I think Houston has the opportunity to capture the lion's share of that build out. And certainly of the products that we're used to building, the kinds of products. Like, we know how to build stuff that has power in it, that has physical structure to it, that has, you know, complex engineering to it. Like, it has electronics in it and software. Like, we know how to build all that stuff here. And a lot of the products today, especially like in the electrification world, they're electromechanical cyber products. They are, it's really the integration of multiple disciplines going into a product.
Sure.
So we have that here, you know, and so we have those capabilities. We have engineers, we have supply chain materials.
We have ports.
We have ports, like the busiest port in America.
Correct.
You know, and so we've got two world-class airports. We've got highway systems. You know, we've got, you know, just like when we were visiting some facilities here recently, we've got facilities with overhead crane capacity, like already installed.
Right, that's right. They're just sitting there unused.
Ready to be used.
That's right.
And so so Houston, you got to come here in Houston, go to build stuff here. I think it's the growth potential is spectacular.
I don't disagree. And it's going to be unique to see how you fill the employment gap that's created when you bring in, you know, let's say 5-10% of, you know, manufacturing. When you reshore that, you're going to have a manufacturing gap. And you can bridge some of that with kind of what you're describing, you know, that, you know, having supplemental equipment that helps to do that.
But you still need lots more people. You still need lots more people. I think that actually is the problem to solve. And, you know, we unfortunately at Alchemy can't really go solve a market problem like that. We have to solve it for ourselves. But I would say that, you know, that's a great business opportunity for people now. There's like a dozen different business models that someone could create just to address that problem. Everything from finding people to training to credentialing to, you know, testing to, engagement to safety. Like, I think I could go on. I just think there's so many different opportunities in that space, and we'll need millions and millions of new people.
Right.
In an environment where we don't have enough people. So, like, classic supply and demand problem. Now, it's great if you become one of those people. Mm-hmm. You've got great pricing power. Like, if I'm a 20-something-year-old person and I choose not to go to college, I'd say, look, get into manufacturing and just keep on doubling down on your ability to learn and improve yourself. You're going to create an incredible living for yourself.
I agree. Why do you think that message is not being communicated to the 20-something-year-old? Why do you think that message is lost on them? Because when I was 20-something years old, no one said, hey, man, you can start driving a forklift and work in manufacturing and make really good wages and probably have a fantastic life.
Sure, yeah.
Why do you think that is not being communicated?
I don't know. It's a good question. I wonder sometimes if in the last few decades we've not had heroes to look toward and look to see, you know, and Elon Musk, obviously controversial in some ways, but the guy's taking on massive manufacturing challenges.
Well, I mean, he's undeniable in that space for sure.
Undeniable. And look, with my kids, in some respects, they see him as someone like, man, that guy's taking on really serious challenges and doing it with cool stuff like rockets. I mean,
yeah, rockets that land themselves.
I know. Can't get cooler than that. Right. And so, so I think some of it is we don't have those heroes anymore. I think some of it is as America outsourced over the last, you know, five decades or so, what happened there was not just that that work went overseas, or that the job went overseas, the know-how also went overseas. So, like, where are the examples of people who perhaps, like I did, have parents mm-hmm. who were making stuff and they could see, oh, this is like honorable work that someone's doing and enough to feed a family? So it could be that. I think
do you think in some cases, because we outsourced it so much, the belief that we're better than that type of work?
Yeah, I think that's something too. I think you're right. I think that is something. Like, it's a maybe not an appreciation for what it is to make something, and you know, and it became like an other, something else that someone else was doing, and that, like, you know, how hard can it be? And
right,
or that, you know, I'd rather go do something else that you might think is, you know, better in some ways. And so, and not that, like, if someone wants to become a neurosurgeon or, you know, whatever, instead of manufacturing, go for it. You know, be absolutely excellent at that. But I think you're right that we've lost our appreciation for how important that is, and that maybe young people over the last few decades have not seen the value of this kind of work.
Sure.
It's not. I think it's recoverable, you know, but it's, man, it is going to be hard.
Like you said, it's probably going to take generations to do it.
It will. We'll take generations. So we better get started now.
Yeah, I don't disagree. And You're affiliated with several organizations that are helping in some of those efforts, you know, in terms of the reshoring and mm-hmm. bringing that focus, you know, and so where can we find more information out about those things?
So one of the organizations that we work with and I work with is an organization called TXRX Labs, and TXRX is a non-profit makerspace. We're actually sitting in one of their offices right now.
This place is cool.
It's amazing.
It's just, if you guys obviously can't see it, but think about like a WeWork or some sort of a collaborative space that's just one after another, people making cool stuff.
Yeah, with all kinds of amazing equipment. So it could be 3D printing, electronics, woodworking, I mean, jewelry making.
There's a dog and a cat.
There's a dog and a cat, yeah, around here. And so
it's very cool. It's a very unique unique place.
Yeah, and you can come here as an individual maker or as a company or even as a large Fortune 500 that needs help with physical innovation. And TXRX can be helpful there. In fact, the building that Alchemy is in is called the East End Maker Hub. Mm-hmm. And the East End Maker Hub is a joint development between TXRX and another organization called UP CDC. And so this development, the 300,000 square foot space that we're in, the whole concept was and is, can we create a sort of a density of manufacturing businesses all in one place? And so the way this space is sort of divided is that about 60,000 square feet is occupied by TXRX, and they execute their nonprofit mission. The remaining 250,000 or so is leased by companies like Alchemy. for-profit businesses in general, and so some of the rent that we pay gets funneled back into TXRX and helps to advance their nonprofit mission.
Right.
And so everything from youth programs, for example, to adult education around makers. So, you know, if you want to learn how to machine, there's a program here. If you want to do other kinds of making skills, you can learn those things. So some of that is funded by for-profit companies like us that are, you know, paying rent that's going back into it. So it's like this really, I think,
very collaborative.
Virtuous sort of cycle of activity that is producing that. And so, you know, if I'm a maker,
I'm gonna have to rent space somewhere.
Yeah, that's right.
So why not rent space in a place that's gonna use part of that rent mm-hmm. to further the thing that I like?
That's the idea. You know, I think that the team here has done an incredible job of leasing out the 300,000 square feet. I think the last number I checked and saw was something like 95% of the space is leased out. And so not everyone has moved in because people are in different stages of making ready space like we had to do. So that takes time to do, but especially today with all the supply chain problems, your entire operation might be waiting on a single fitting, you know.
That's right.
Sadly. And so why we should make stuff here.
It's a great argument for it.
It is.
For sure.
It's like the argument. So this place, I think if you come back by the end of 2022, it'll be even more sort of busy than it is now. We moved in, I think it was February of 2021. I think we were one of the first people to mm-hmm. actually occupy. And, you know, we would go months without seeing anyone. But now, like every day, there are people in the hallway walking around, you know.
It's been a real test for my ADD because there's this wall behind us is all glass. So yeah. If people come by, it's hard not to look up.
But, it is, yeah. It's worth, so if you're in the Houston area and you want to learn about TXRX and their mission, or you want to learn about the East End Maker Hub and everything that's happening here, you know, reach out to me and I'm happy to help make that happen. I'm on the board of TXRX
okay.
also.
So where can people find you to reach out?
You know, send up the bat signal.
I
think that's the best way.
LinkedIn, man, you're pretty active on LinkedIn.
I'm very active
on
LinkedIn.
So that was a great place to connect. And then now I have your personal email, so that's a mistake that you've made.
Right, yeah. So I think LinkedIn is probably the best way. If someone's listening, just message me on LinkedIn. So Mush Khan, Mushkhan. And so you can find me all over LinkedIn. All I do is talk about making shit and making stuff here.
It's fantastic. And again, I really appreciate your time, your insights into kind of how you got out and started Alchemy. You know, very interesting to hear how you made these observations about these three things that were going on in that mm-hmm. space and said, okay, how do I get ahead of that?
Yeah.
And how do I put something in place that's meaningful? And
yeah,
man, I wish you nothing but continued success.
Oh,
amazing stories about
you.
With the space that you're in, and you shared a couple things with me that are, you know, confidential, and I won't disclose those here. But man, it's been great getting to talk to you.
Oh,
I
likewise.
Know it's a long conversation, and we had to deal with the lights and the cameras and the whatever else. But
that's okay. None of that's important.
None of it's important. The message is what's important, and I know that came through. So
thank you.
Thank you so much. And
sure,
I think I will try to come back out in the end of 2022 and see what's changed.
You're welcome back sooner than that with us too. One note for you too, and what you're doing, which I think is incredibly valuable. You know, I think that progress is only made by advancing good ideas. And I think the people that can help bring good ideas out and have conversations with them, in some ways, that's the most valuable thing that we can do. So what you're doing in terms of having interviews with people like me and others is getting ideas out. And I think that is intensely valuable. And so I'm glad that you're doing what you're doing. We're so honored to be on your podcast, and you know, we want to be supportive of you because what you're doing is critical.
I appreciate that, and that is the vision of it. There's no right way to do entrepreneurship.
No, there's not.
But there are ways.
That's
and having those conversations is the only way to know them. So
yeah.
Without guys like you, I don't get to do this, and I'm really happy. So
yeah.
I really appreciate everything, and man, we'll catch up some other time.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Con.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.